Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Hello.
Jason, me boy.
Jim.
How are you?
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Well, I was just looking at your paintings for the first time, very last minute, but I didn't know about them until my wife, who says hello, by the way, mentioned them. And I was very impressed. I'm not really a painting person or an art critic by any means, but it seemed very accomplished to me.
Thank you very much. I'm pretty serious about it, and I don't know. I'm serious about it, and I had some training as a young person, so I keep doing it.
Is it a meditative thing for you?
Pardon me?
Is it a meditative thing for you to paint?
It certainly is, yes. It takes me out of a particular portion of my brain and puts me in another place that I like to be in. It's a relief from writing. It's a relief from thinking in the way that, you know, thinking in words all the time.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so, and I do sell them, you know, so I sell about, I don't know, 2 or 3 a year in a average year, and I sell them for about $1,500, so I make a little walking around money.
That's great.
And it's a nice avocation or semi-vocation.
Mm-hmm. Seemed like there was an element of documentation there as well.
Actually. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm recording the landscape of my time and place. The only thing I regret is that I don't have any peasants available in the field. I have automobiles, but unlike Van Gogh, I don't have a ready supply of peasants posing against the haystacks.
Right. Well, it wouldn't be documentation if you were trying to present your ideal landscape.
Oh, for sure. I'm very much against idealizing, you know, making it super picturesque. In fact, I regard the picturesque as a trap, generally speaking, and I try to find some other way of describing what I'm seeing. I'm interested in the human imprint on the landscape, mostly.
Hmm. Well, let's start with you as a writer. I mean, as a non-fiction writer, because I think that you do adopt positions that you're aware are provocative, and I don't read your comments. I suspect that you don't either. So many of them, but I know that you stir up a lot of controversy. Right? So let's start with that. Just your experience of being a writer, a communicator in this liminal realm in which ideology is becoming more and more restrictive and oppressive, I would say, and in which actually the opportunity or the space to simply state facts is becoming more and more fraught.
Yes. I don't know that I am primarily a controversialist, that I'm dedicated to just stirring people up and you know, provoking them to be angry and irritated by what I say. I'm interested as a writer in being interesting, because of course if you lose the audience, you know, then you can't function as a writer. So I'm interested always in trying to be as interesting as possible. But I don't know, it's my fate, for better or for worse, to live in a time and place where I think a great deal of what passes for conventional thinking is false, or at least to some degree doesn't comport with reality as I understand it. And so, you know, I make a weekly attempt in my blog anyway to confront that that state of affairs, and often by trying to state what I think is the truth. And I think it's very hard for my fellow readers and my auditors, the people who, you know, who get annoyed at me chronically. It's very hard for them to process what I'm saying sometimes, and I suppose it's a little bit harsh. Now, for example, I think that there's a lot of mystification over what's going on the campuses right now. We've just come out of a season of probably the most exaggerated and horrific demonstrations of political correctness that any of us have seen for quite a while. You know, you have the students on the Amherst campus in Massachusetts protesting against free speech because it's too hurtful.
So are they not presumably expressing it in exactly those terms?
They did, and yes, pretty much. That's what made the Amherst protest stand out, was that they actually at one point employed those very words. In so many words, they came out against free speech as being not protective enough of their feelings and their trauma. And there was the incident at Princeton where the Black student organization inveighed against Woodrow Wilson, the former president of Princeton University and president of the United States, and inveighed against the university, naming buildings after him and organizations after him and foundations and stuff. And you know, what was amazing to me about it was when they presented the president of Princeton, the current president, with their list of demands, you know, to eradicate the memory of Woodrow Wilson based on his being a segregationist. At the very same time, they presented a demand to have a new segregated black-only student union or student center of some kind just for black students. And I just thought, you know, the nerve of this group doing that. And the cowardice of the president of Princeton not standing up for reality. You know.
Well, so yeah. So that.
And of course, was the University of Missouri incident too. You know, where the chancellor of the whole state university system resigned, so this has been going on for a while. It happened to coincide with an incident in my life where I gave a lecture at Boston College in October, and I had dinner with several faculty members after the talk. Now, the talk that I gave was based on some of my recent books, The Long Emergency, World Made by Hand series, Too Much Magic. And so, you know, I was talking about shale oil and the banking situation and the future of our cities and the issues that have to do with sort of long emergency stuff and how people are going to survive the transition that we're probably heading into. And, you know, it had nothing to do with any of the really hot button issues that are raging across campus right now. But at the dinner afterwards, which was a private dinner in a restaurant, I was sitting with these three English lit profs who told me, all of them told me that they specialized in race, gender, and privilege issues. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh boy, that's amazing that they need that many people to teach race, privilege, and gender, you know.
What's privilege in this context?
Oh, you know, what's privilege? Privilege is the hallucination that, you know, that white people have it so easy in life that nothing bad ever happens to them. And conversely, that everything bad that ever happens to other peoples is the fault of white people.
Right.
So, okay. Not something I particularly believe in. But because, you know, they were all race, gender, and privilege specialists, we were talking about some race issues. And I put my two cents in, which was, something I've been campaigning for a couple of years, actually, which is that the most useful thing that education could do for the black community would be to teach the speaking of English correctly in the schools and make that a high priority, which I don't think it is. In fact, I think that it's not a priority at all. And a couple of the English profs at the table seemed to be amazed that I said that, and amazed and injured. And we argued about that for a while, whether that idea had any validity. And they maintained that it didn't, that, you know, to teaching black people how to speak English correctly was absolutely of no value.
By correctly, do you mean grammatically?
Yeah, I mean grammatically. I mean in terms of, you know, understanding tenses, because, if you say everything in the present tense, you're liable to not have a very clear idea about the difference between yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And, I maintain that it affects the way people behave in their life. For instance, you know, if you don't know the difference between yesterday, today, and tomorrow, you might have trouble showing up on time for things. I just maintain that I think all in all, it would be a positive thing if we taught people to speak English correctly. And right now, our culture is kind of militating against that. And not for very good reasons, in my opinion. Anyway, the next day, I got flamed on social media by a black woman professor who heard reports of the discussion at the dinner table. She was not present at the dinner table. And then commenced to start calling me names and calling me a racist and on Twitter or Facebook or something.
Mm-hmm. So you just heard about this by proxy when actually...
She heard about it by proxy.
Yeah.
Yeah, she sent me an email telling me that she was going to flame me on social media. And then she got my email off of my website and then proceeded to flame me on social media. And this is, you know, basically character assassination by social media, which is now a new fashion on campus. And interestingly, it's a fashion among the faculty, who I think ought to know better. You know, especially these people who appear or pretend to be grappling with social and moral issues, apparently, and ethical issues. But apparently one of the things they're not too concerned about are the ethics of the Internet and how the Internet might be used. And so they're all for character assassination by social media. That's their new racket. So I didn't appreciate that. But it was interesting to me that very week, the campuses all over America exploded with all of this protest and marching and disruption. And I don't think it was because of anything. I mean, I don't think they were following my lead or anything. I think I just caught the crest of a wave that was breaking.
Mm-hmm. What were they protesting?
Well, the main thing was the protest that grew out of the Black Lives Matter movement. And You know, that's an outgrowth of the killings in Ferguson and Carolina and now Chicago and elsewhere, where there's perceived to be a campaign by policemen to murder black people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, one of the things that that goes unmentioned in that controversy is the fact that black people are doing a very good job of slaughtering each other, a much better job than the police are doing. And that might lead you to the position that maybe black lives don't matter to black people. But, you know, there's, I don't know what more there is to say about that for the moment. But in any case, there were uproars all over the campuses and demands for all kinds of special new diversity offices and programs and deans and claims of lacking safe places on campus for students to feel okay about themselves and so on.
Right.
And then there was the uproar at Yale that followed about a week later, after Halloween or around Halloween time, when one of the house masters at one of the colleges at Yale, who is a faculty member who lives in the basically in the dormitory building with her husband as kind of a, you know, a house manager, she responded to a memo sent out by the Yale administration, which said something like, students must be very careful about the Halloween costumes that they choose, and they shouldn't choose costumes that are going to offend anybody, especially, you know, costumes based on, you know, being Indians or pirates or blackface or any of the many things we've seen over the years. And so this this faculty slash house master at Yale response sent an email in response to this memo saying that students ought to be considered mature enough adults to be able to deal with their own choices of Halloween costumes and whatever the consequences were of donning whatever you decide to don. And she was immediately beset by angry, screaming students who, you know, demanded that, you know, made all kinds of demands, including, I think, that she no longer be able to be, you know, a resident house master at the college. So she ended up resigning from her classes this year. She didn't resign her teaching post, but she, in response, the faculty and the administration did not back her up in any way. They didn't say that she had a right to express herself, nor did they respond to the points that she actually made, that maybe the students ought to be considered mature enough to make their own decisions about what kind of Halloween costumes they put on. In any case, this week that we're talking, she resigned the two classes that she was teaching for the year. She's not going to teach them anymore. And her husband also went on sabbatical. And she accompanied that with a note that said why she was doing it, because, you know, the campus is no longer a congenial place for free inquiry and free speech. And I think she's correct. And, you know, I think the bottom line of this for me, and what is so astounding, is the amazing cowardice of the authorities involved, namely the administration executives of the colleges and the faculty, and their failure to back up free speech, and their pandering to their students as though they were just customers at a store, and allowing really any kind of unappetizing behavior around that, you know, the intimidating of people who are trying to speak freely. In the case of the University of Missouri, manhandling and intimidating a student journalist who was simply trying to cover a protest march, and things like that. So, mm-hmm. You know, you have this amazing climate on campus now of kind of Maoist totalitarianism among young people. And it's kind of an amazing phenomenon. So how it relates to the to our liminal times, I'm not sure, but I think that there's a lot of ripe area for discussion about that.
Hmm.
You know, about what it is that students may be sensing that is prompting them to this strange behavior. And I would think that it has a great deal to do with the fact that at some level they view their own activities in college as being silly and frivolous and meaningless.
And worse. I mean, it's founded on destructive power structures and destructive ideologies. I mean, when you're talking about the past history of what's his name? Sorry, it's hard for me to keep track of all of these details because it's so overwhelming, the culture. But the ex-president, was it Wilson?
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson, and you know, being a segregationist. Well, of course, back in those days, that was just normal, right? It's easy to look back on cultural beliefs and judge them and judge the people who held them. But of course, in the context in which they were held, they were considered the right beliefs, and the same applies today, right? The beliefs that we hold and think of as sacrosanct will be looked upon by future generations as insane. I mean, they
yeah,
just seem
exactly.
to be becoming manifestly insane before our eyes. So there seems to be some sort of exponential spiraling going on there. But anyway, my point, if I can make it, was that. That it's when people start to see, to suspect, at a visceral level anyway, that the institutions and the ideologies, the beliefs and the values that are their meat and potatoes and that sustain their lives are basically unsound. That's a very unsafe position to be in. So the thing is to find a way to redirect that sense of panic and anxiety and recontextualize it as some sort of outrage, as in you can act on it, because
mm-hmm.
you can't really act on anxiety, you just run. So it's fight or flight. When you're in the when you're feeling the flight mechanism, the way to compensate or deal with that is to switch over into fight. And then but then you've also got to find the right thing to fight. You can't fight your own family or your own peers or your own institutions that you depend on, so then you have to find the scapegoat. And the thing, looking in the past is one way, well, let's pick some president that is an icon and attack him because that's completely safe. But then the much more volatile is when you find targets in the present, you look for the scapegoats in the present. So, and then when you talk about the cowardice, I think that relates to that. That when that's beginning to happen,
mm-hmm.
When that anxiety is growing and there's a sense of the instability of the group and the institutions and everything, then a target, a scapegoat has to be found. And essentially those who are supposedly directing that group or facilitate or whatever, you know, in a positions of authority, the last thing they can afford to do is align with the scapegoat. And the scapegoat mechanism is essential to keeping the community together.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Girard's view, but I think it's really worth exploring that. And so, yeah, on the one hand, at personal level, you could say that's cowardice not to actually stand up for the voices that are speaking the truth and are actually saying this is what's happening and to align with the kind of mob. But on the other hand, it's strategic, it's instinctive, but it's also political strategy, because if you align with the scapegoat, not only can it no longer be scapegoated, but you yourself risk being scapegoated.
Yeah, sure. And I think that's probably what a lot of these deans and college presidents sense. And also that under those circumstances, just about anybody will be hung out to dry.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, it's sort of like the French Revolution. And I think your theory is a good theory. The part that I have a problem with is that I think that the actual behavior that we're seeing is based on a heavily constructed story. And that story is based on this new fashionable phrase called white privilege, and the idea that the failures of all other people are due to the privileged position of white people, and I just don't buy it. I don't buy that.
Right. Well, so that isn't that scapegoating too, isn't it? I mean, that's scapegoating the white man, which there's a sort of irony and symmetry in that, because I mean, there is historical validity in the oppression of women by men and of black people by white people. There's a historical basis for it, but the basis is, the larger context of that basis is scapegoating, that any group that is dominant enough to define the ideology, the narrative, will do so by and congruent with finding a scapegoat and another to reinforce that identity thereby. So it's just a kind of black irony that that is happening now, and that sort of the hens have come home to roost in a certain sense, although I would agree with you that the narrative itself is flawed, because I mean at so many different levels, and I've been getting into this around feminism, that even the notion of misogyny, and I'm going out on a limb now even mentioning the word because of how I've, my views on this, is even the notion of misogyny is weirdly distorting. It's a distorted narrative, because oppression and abuse is occurring across the board to all colours, races, sexes, creeds, you name it. It's universal, the exploitation, the abuse, the oppression and the suffering. So to single out one particular group and say this is happening and this is misogyny or this is privilege, as you're describing this other narrative, is a distortion because it's ignoring the underlying reality, which is, that would be harder to define, because then I would end up possibly creating my own narrative, but I would say, pertinent to your last blog post, although it wasn't directly about it, the systemized, institutionalized child abuse, which has actually gone on throughout history, and it's actually as horrific as it is now, it seems that it was far, far worse. I mean, it's been getting steadily less horrific throughout history. Has been so great, it's had such a great impact on us as a species, that there's a pretty strong argument for the fact that we're collectively dissociated by trauma, and we're not even able to really talk about history or reality, because we've come up with this illusory idea of agency, that we're all actually making conscious, rational decisions, and that's what's driving history, when the truth may be closer to the opposite of that, that we're all in this dissociated, traumatized state, acting on unconscious trauma reenactment drives, to unconsciously reenact traumas from childhood.
Well, if that's true of all of us, then it would be hard to argue against it. So I can't really find a position to argue that with you. It's an interesting idea, but I can't say I'm persuaded that it's true.
No, I wouldn't want to try and persuade you, because then I'd have to start citing references and all that. So it was kind of my, I can't, if I'm going to try and offer a counter narrative to misogyny or white privilege or any of these things that you and I both agree are false narratives, that's the best I can do. And it's like,
in a conversation of this kind, I think it ought to be self-evident that, we are doing the best we can do, and that, if it's a highly intellectualized discussion, that, parties are going to come up with theories that are not completely baked, maybe they're half-baked, maybe they are truthful, and we're doing the best we can to be truthful. Well, I think it's very important, just, if you pretend to be an intellectual, to at least show some respectful skepticism of your own ideas.
Yeah,
Not to mention the other fellow's ideas, but but of our own ideas. And I certainly feel that way about mine. You know, a lot of the things that I say, I offer up for what they're worth. You know, I hope that they are truthful. And sometimes I can't prove it. And, you know, and I always leave the door open to be persuaded that, you know, somebody else's view of it is better than mine.
That's an impression I've got of you, and it's one of the things I like about you, and it makes it, I think, possible for us to talk, beside the fact that we do have an area of overlap that we can talk about, but we also have a large area of non-overlap where we could completely disagree and end up actually at loggerheads. Besides just avoiding those subjects, there's this that you're describing here that I think makes a much deeper common ground, which isn't about beliefs or ideas or interpretations, but about approaches to reality, let's say. And for me, one of the tells about that with you and your work is that it's very rounded. So on the one hand, you're a polemicist, if that's not too...
No, I think it's true.
Limiting a word, but anyway, you discourse on culture and what's going on. But on the other hand, you write this very beguiling fiction, which has this deep magical underlayer. And I find it as, if not more, compelling and convincing than your polemics. Like, it seems to me you have your own hidden magical side, which you don't hide. But you've compartmentalized the two.
Yeah,
and
well,
they complement each other very nicely. And yeah, anyway.
Yeah, in these four particular novels that I've written that go under the rubric of the World Made by Hand series, there is a lot of magic, and you know, for reasons that actually we've discussed before, the world that's depicted in these novels is, in some ways, also a liminal world. Certainly, in terms of people living now in our time, reading about a future time that is very different, and you know, the friction between those two states of mind. And so one of the features of the depicted future world is that you know, there are people who are deeply religious and kind of living in a re-enchanted world, a world re-enchanted by religious belief and belief in the supernatural. And then there are the people who have been left very disappointed by the promises of technology and logical positivism and really all of the baggage of the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And so in that realm between their disappointment and the re-enchantment of life of the other characters, you know, that's the liminal realm that I'm particularly interested in those novels.
Mm-hmm. So, but you yourself would identify as non-religious.
Yes.
And as a disbeliever.
Yeah.
In the supernatural.
Yeah. As a general proposition, yeah. Although I think that there are realms and regions of psychology that where things happen that resemble magic.
Right.
And, you know, these have to do with, you know, psychological transformations, largely, you know, of how people move from one state to another. And clearly people do. I mean, they move from being depressed to being, you know, strong, joyful. People move from hatefulness and anger to love. And,
so they're talking about internal transformations.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things coming to mind, both relate to writers. One is that famous Arthur C. Clarke thing that any technology sufficiently advanced to us would be indistinguishable from magic.
Yes. And
what you're saying seems like a much more interesting version of that, which would be any form of psychological experience sufficiently deep enough would be indistinguishable.
That's exactly right.
To us. From magic, which I think is a great idea, and I completely agree. The other thing that came to mind was this author, Paul Bowles. I think I brought him up last time I sent you the piece I wrote about him. Anyway, have you read Paul Bowles?
I never did read Paul Bowles, although I did read your essay about him, and I was interested in it. I can't find myself interested enough in Paul Bowles, the figure and the writer. I just, you know, he represents to me just a kind of social degeneracy that bugs me.
That's interesting.
And you know, effeteness and dilettantism that just bugs me.
Right, so you have a sort of temperamental aversion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't, because I actually grew up in that climate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a temperamental affinity, but at this stage in the game I have a narrow conscious aversion and a distrust of that kind of alignment, if you will. So that's interesting to hear you say that.
Yeah.
I'm now fraternizing with more healthy influences, I guess. Anyway, the point about Paul Bowles was that he said in an interview, because he lived in North Africa for most of his life, and he was asked by one of the interviewers that, you know, did he believe in magic? And he said, I'm a Westerner, I can't possibly believe in the supernatural. But then he, perhaps in the same interview or in another interview, he described experiences he'd had in North Africa where he'd witnessed supernatural phenomena, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. right? So it was as though he allowed those two positions or those two views to coexist. Well, he didn't feel the need to reconcile them. He knew that the so-called supernatural existed because he'd seen it, but with the belief system or the identity that he had, he also knew that he couldn't possibly believe in it.
Yeah, I would have to discount what he's saying to some degree because he was stoned all the time. And, you know, I mean, God knows what... you know what you're going to experience, or how, you know, when you're, you know, when you're using hashish all the time, a lot of things can seem like an hallucination. So,
well, I think that's a bit of an easy shot.
It is an easy shot, but I think it's true.
Yeah. Well, I think it's true generally, but in this case, I don't want to get sucked into the details. But there are phenomena in North Africa which have been recorded and documented that he was describing, which can't be explained by science. And you probably know there's all kinds of these phenomena, right, that we could choose to put a label of supernatural. But it seems as though that itself is a belief system that is in some way the wrong one. It's like a rational interpretation of something that doesn't need to be interpreted rationally, which perhaps is back to this, the psyche. I mean, if the psyche is real, then it's as real as the body, and so it's almost like two separate realities that coexist, and they're both equally real, and maybe this criteria we have that one is real because it's physical, and the other is unreal because it's psychic or whatever, that itself is a unnecessary restriction on our experience, right?
Well, actually, I wouldn't argue about the point that you made about Paul Bowles's supernatural experiences in North Africa. The only thing that I did argue is that he might not be the most reliable reporter.
Yeah. That part I agree with. Having been a psychedelic pioneer for a couple of decades and come to see just that, really, just how much distortion comes with you actively kind of hijack the senses in order to try and access that sort of experience. But to bring it back to you and the writing, because when you put yourself into the novels, as every writer does, and so the characters that are most interesting in this context, anyway, are those who are not religious, and so they're not naturally aligned with the supernatural. They're more these disillusioned types who are having to deal with the loss of technology and all the rest of it. But they are witnessing these impossible new experiences or aspects of reality and embracing them.
Yeah. For example, I have a character in all of those World Made by Hand books who is the congregational minister. And, you know, I made a conscious choice among other things. By the way, there's very little profanity in these books, and that was a deliberate choice too, because at a certain point it became obvious to me that if you're living in a society where the rule of law is very weak, then you can't be just casually cursing at people because you might get hurt.
Right.
So the characters in my book do very little of that, except for the congregational minister, who's really rather free with his use of profanity. So I was interested in the position that he was in as a clergyman who is not really that much of a believer, but who finds himself in the strange position of now being at the center of his community because all of the other pieces of the social armature have fallen away. You know, there's no more corporations. There's no more organized school system, really. There's... You know, the courts are not operating. So there's very little institutional armature left for people to hang their lives on, except for the congregational church. And so he's thrust in the position of all of a sudden being really a community leader in a way that he hadn't been in what they call the old times. So I was particularly interested in him and how his mind operates. And so in one of those books in particular, where he's in the foreground for much of the book, which is the Witch of Hebron, the second of the four novels, he's largely struggling with his own belief and his own sense of what God consists of and what the universe is and what his place in it really is, apart from any of the Christian dogma that, you know, that he's trained in. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he, you know, at one point he attempts to commit suicide and fails. And having been in that liminal place of wanting to end his existence, that changes and failed. That changes him psychologically, and makes him stronger, as it turns out. Anyway, you mentioned that other character I created, Andrew Pendergast, mm-hmm. Who's a gay man. I guess he's about 40 years old, and you know, he's come to this little. He sort of bailed out of New York City, and the scene there, before the troubles really got underway, and managed to establish a place for himself and a life for himself in this community before that happened. But now that that's over, and you know, because the storyline in all of these novels is that you know, life is kind of settling back down at a much lower reset place after these various troubles have happened, you know, the collapse of the economy and a major war in the Middle East and the destruction of a couple of American cities and the breaking up of the country into kind of semi-autonomous regions and or actually completely autonomous regions and so on. And, you know, what Andrew realizes is that all of the cultural stagecraft and trappings and claptrap and ideology that had him in the midst of a gay life, you know, no longer exist to support that notion of himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's left to work out what his place really is. And among these is the question of how much of his own gayness it was a social construction. And because I'm not persuaded, you know, I among the things that people, I think, are very impatient with me about is that I'm not persuaded that people are born gay. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a Christian fundamentalist, but I'm not sure that I buy that story. Mm-hmm. You know, for my money, and for what it's worth, you know, I think that it's a developmental issue, and that there are other ways of explaining what that state consists of.
Mm-hmm. Ones that it's pretty hard to actually put forth in today's climate, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you are not allowed to have a contrary idea or opinion about that. It's just verboten. It's a new taboo. And you know, I wanted to explore it fictionally. And as it happens, I got a certain amount of flack from it, you know, after the fact, after it was published. You know, people...
I was wondering about
that. ...objected to it. Yeah, I was on... Camo on the Sea Realm podcast had a couple of gay guys on who were discussing this element of my novel. And, of course, the most interesting thing about the discussion was that both of these guys said that they hadn't read the book. So, you know, they were just really... kind of going on innuendo and hearsay.
Yeah.
But they both objected hugely to the fact that this guy wasn't getting enough sex. And the character appeared to not be, you know, having enough sex with other men.
Right. So you'd created a gay character and then not given him enough gay activity.
Yeah, had not furnished him with enough gay activity. So that was funny.
So that was more their objection than your premise that his homosexuality was a social construction.
Well, Camo actually had read the book, and he, you know, I think that he outlined, you know, what I had laid out pretty fairly, and you know, they took it from there. And I think that they objected to that. Yeah, they did. No question about it. They object to that, but and I think that there's hardly any imaginable quarter that you could go to these days among, political progressives who would not object to that. And as it happens, I'm not a right winger. As it happens, in American political terms, I'm a registered Democrat and have been for about 40 years. But I'm increasingly disenchanted with what I find on that side of the spectrum, but I'm not enchanted with what I find on the other side of the spectrum. So,
sure.
So both sides right now are pretty unappetizing.
Yeah, that's an understatement from where I'm sitting. So with that, I mean, that's a huge subject in itself, needless to say, the homosexuality. So, and then you brought it out even to an even larger thing.
Let me actually take this a bit further, Jason.
Okay.
What happens to this character in the book is that he becomes involved with a younger man who is one of these people in the New Times who's failing to make a life for himself. And he takes him in to his house. And he takes him in and begins to employ him as a servant, kind of a manservant. Mm-hmm. And it's not a sexual relationship. And that was another thing that these guys objected to hugely, that he would find a way to have a different kind of relationship with a young man than other than putting his dick in him. Mm-hmm. And what I was trying to actually illuminate in this relationship was that in this new social paradigm, there would probably be more people who had to work as servants, and that would end up reflecting great changes in social hierarchies. And so there's a great deal of discussion in the book by various characters, including this particular one, about employing servants in their households, because the electricity is no longer running, and almost all the work has to be done by live human beings now rather than machines.
Right. Now, so they want the future to be politically correct.
Yeah. So they objected to the fact that, this guy had become a household servant. Mm-hmm. And that was just, something that I wanted to underscore in the book.
Right. Well, so and in relation to that, what you're just saying about the reasoning behind having servants, in a completely altered social environment that in itself was kind of liminal because it's new and unstable.
Exactly.
Then sexuality would also completely transform. I mean, unless we're arguing, as is so popular now, that this is all, that our own sort of conscious choices about what we choose to identify with are biologically ordained. There's a weird sort of paradox in it, because biology is being removed from the equation, and then the ego is being put forward as having a biological, empirical kind of weight to it.
That's a very good point.
Congruent with that. Yeah, it was just occurring to me now in the context of what you're describing in the novel. And so, yeah, our sexuality is such a profound part of how we move in the world. And society, of course, is so invested in our sexuality and politics and identity politics. Who knows what sexual expression would be like? Like the thing you're saying about profanity not being safe when the institutions and the laws were no longer that present, the same would probably be true of sexual expression.
Oh yeah, I think absolutely. And we're probably living in a historical moment when people feel a lot more safe actually about what their promptings are, and in other periods of history, you have to be more careful about what your promptings are. Your private promptings have to remain private, and they don't enter the political arena the way they have in our time.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to bring it back to the novel itself and what you were doing there, because when I read that passage, I had the feeling that what Jim's doing here, and I didn't object. I mean, first of all, you've said that the World Made by Hand novels were, that you had a sort of intention behind them. There was a sort of kind of soft propaganda in it, and that you wanted to introduce people to the possibility that the end of civilization might not be a bad thing, and this is how we might be able to transition. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, although I didn't use the term the end of civilization. It was more like the transition that we were going to go through from, you know, this in the form of this long emergency between, you know, the end of techno-industrial civilization and whatever form of civilization follows it, you know, may land us in a place that actually finds, you know, many joys and satisfactions that we've lost in our, you know, pursuit of techno-narcissistic life.
And you're comfortable with the suggestion that there's a polemic element to the novels?
Yes.
That you want to... Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So that was my feeling about the homosexuality, was that you have an understanding or an interpretation or about homosexuality that isn't very popular now and isn't very safe to even try and communicate or express, and so you incorporate it into the novel.
Yeah.
So it seemed that it was a polemical element to that. I personally didn't object because I personally agree, and I think it is a subject that needs to be addressed. And I know homosexual men who refute the idea of homosexuality having a biological basis. So it isn't necessarily, as with feminists, the advocates of feminism aren't necessarily women, and they aren't necessarily representing the interests of women. And the same with mm-hmm. with these defenders of homosexuality, right? So anyway, but the point I was getting to here was that if that's what you're doing with the novel, then I guess you have to allow that you, in a certain sense, you're setting yourself up for being criticized for that. Whereas if you were just writing pure fiction
about it, you know, I expected that people would object to it, you know, but you know, but I do get to say what I want to say.
Right.
And then, you know, the consequences are people, you know, some people will object, and you know, then we can either have a debate or a discussion about it or not. Most of my auditors and critics don't want to have a discussion. They just want to shut down the discussion.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that tells you something about, you know, the nature of where they're coming from.
It does, yeah. That they believe they're absolutely right, and they have the dominant ideology behind them, and essentially, you need to be educated or silenced.
Right, which is just another form of totalitarianism, really.
It is.
You know, everywhere around us. And I'm, you know, as I said at the end of that blog post about the incident at Boston College, you know, as far as the neo-Maoists and would-be totalitarians are concerned, I'm their enemy. Mm-hmm. And I'm declaring that I am their enemy. You know, I'm not making any bones about it.
Do you want to be in a position of being somebody's enemy?
Yeah, because I think this is a worthwhile fight. I think it's I think it's worth fighting against intellectual despotism.
think it's worth fighting for something, which is my own sense of what's real and true, simply because I have to, it's the only way for me to stay sane and to feel any, something like safe in my own environment. And that does often come to potentially making enemies, but certainly opposing ideological stonewalling and trying to get around it. But I guess I'm more of a martial artist, or I aspire to being more of a martial artist, which is using the force of the opponent against the opponent, right, rather than opposing it directly.
No, I think that's a very good idea. If unfortunately, I have no training in martial arts, although I recognize that you know, intellectual jujitsu is a very good way to go with that.
So earlier I was thinking, like when you, at the beginning of this conversation, you talked quite a bit about the specifics and things around universities and the charges of racism that you incurred and all of that. And there were details there that I could have questioned or objected to, and I certainly didn't want to, because I didn't want to get pulled into the details of the culture, because they're endless, right? But
yeah.
it occurred to me that the one thing that you and I probably do disagree about, and it's more than a disagreement or less than, but it's kind of an approach or a position, or is that you seem to be, and I think there's an interesting paradox in here, or contradiction for me, looking at you and your work, you seem to be into, like, because you were talking about educating people to speak the English language yeah. better as a desirable thing. Yeah. Well, that seems to me to contradict your embracing as a fiction writer the transitioning into this more liberal, less ideological, this movement away from strong institutionalized society, right? There seems to be a counter instinct in you to try and preserve and improve and direct society in ways that can actually salvage something from the wreckage, whereas I'm completely not in that way. I'm somebody who temperamentally embraces the apocalypse or the collapse of all of these things, even while I enjoy the conveniences that yeah. they provide. But I don't feel any desire to try and salvage or correct the institutions or the ideologies. I feel that they're completely inherently unworkable, and that we're just seeing the kind of full expression or the full realization of that, of something that was flawed from the very inception that has finally reached its apotheosis. So liberalism became neoliberalism, which has become a weird alternate form of fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially is what we're seeing, I think. And so, but it was there in the...
Well, you've covered a lot of ground in the last 5 minutes. And I guess the one thing that I feel I would like to respond to is the idea that speaking English correctly... I wouldn't call an institution, you know, it's...
No, but it would be an institutional solution, because you'd be... you're talking about the universities and what they can do, and...
You see what I mean? What I was saying was not about the universities. It was the original remark I made in the conversation with the Boston College faculty people was that it should be the primary mission of secondary schools and grammar schools to teach younger children from the very beginning how to speak English.
And okay, they're so not doing still,
they're just not doing it. And I don't think that that's ever a bad thing to really have facility with the language of the culture you're in. You know, I'd have to point out at this juncture that it's very ironic that that at this point in our in our so-called civilization, when we've reached such a high pitch of industrial virtuosity, mm-hmm. that our language skills have decayed as much as they have. Mm-hmm. Now, if you remember those letters that were featured in Ken Burns' Civil War documentary of the soldiers who wrote the common soldiers. Who wrote letters home, and how beautiful,
right.
eloquent they were, and how very ordinary people had tremendous facility with language. Four or five generations ago, that has been completely lost.
And with discourse, the power of discourse and debate.
Yeah,
and all of those skills that were absolutely essential to maintaining a community and further the sort of political maintenance of a community.
And by the way, you know, that was underscored by the fact that in the university curriculum, speech and rhetoric had a very important place. Those two things were abolished around the time that I went off to college in the 1960s. You know, those two fields of studies of study were literally abolished. They took them out of the curriculum and they weren't taught anymore. Right. So, you know, it's interesting that we don't regard that as having any importance. And now it shows, you know, and I think what it shows increasingly is really an inability to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to be clear, I'm not questioning the validity of being able to think and being able to use language. What I'm questioning is the belief or the faith that institutional change can be corrected or redirected, and that what we're seeing now isn't part of a behemoth, really, that is moving with such weight behind it that any minor changes we could suggest or implement are completely ineffective. So, I mean, I noticed this in some of your posts, that there's this, it seems to be a growing thing, a conflict between actually wanting to address solutions and possible ways to redress the problem with a growing resignation to the fact that culture is essentially insane and that there isn't really much we can do about it.
Yeah, well, and then there's a third kind of thread there, which is there are any number of people who do want to address the ability to you know, change with the behemoth, but they want to do it by means that are delusional. You know, for example, there are a great many people who recognize that we're probably going to have a problem with our fossil fuel energy supply in some form or other. You know, either scarcities or price problems or geopolitical problems. You know, and their so-called solution to that is the Tesla car. You know, is to transform the American motoring system into an electric motoring system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's not going to happen, and that it's wishful thinking. And you know, what's interesting to me is that, you know, all that really represents is extending extreme car dependency yet another generation. You know, nobody ever thinks about the so-called solution being maybe living in walkable communities. And, of course, this is something that bugs me a great deal. But so I put that in the wishful thinking folder, and there's a whole, you know, there's a whole other bunch of things that are in that, like the idea that we're going to run Walmart and the American military and Walt Disney World on solar and wind. You know, that's not going to happen either, but there are an awful lot of people who are... and they're well-intentioned people, but I think they're completely deluded about how that works. And their principal delusion is that solar and wind power can be done independent of a supporting fossil fuel economy. So, so that's the third sort of the third arm of what's out there.
I would think that's the main one thing. I mean, initially I was talking about yourself, so I wasn't going to suggest that you were proposing delusional solutions. But I would say that possibly some of your conflict, if this isn't being too bold, is seeing more and more how the belief in solutions itself is delusional and is founded in delusion.
Well, that's why, you know, when I'm doing this, the university lectures, I try to explicitly say that we should make a distinction between so-called solutions and intelligent responses to what we're facing, you know.
Yeah.
I want to say something about what you mentioned previously about teaching English within an institutional framework that is actually dissolving. And what I mainly wanted to say about it was that the kind of social changes that I'm describing are really emergent, in the sense that, you know, they're self-organizing. And in my World Made by Hand novels, for instance, there's a kind of a trope in there that I think very few people actually understood or caught. Some of the people who caught it didn't understand it. And it's simply this, that the younger characters in the book, the ones that are in their 20s, you know, who did not really experience living in the older times, they have adopted a much more formal manner of speech than the middle-aged people in the book. And, you know, I did that deliberately because it seemed to me that young people growing up all of a sudden in a society that no longer had the internet or television or any kind of really electronic media, you know, would have to develop better language skills simply to communicate, you know, everyday stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, that's in there. And in case anybody doesn't understand it, that's my explanation for it.
Okay. So, I mean, if we're talking about language, because you keep bringing it back to that,
mm-hmm.
I do think it's very fundamental. I mean, that the social identity is to a large extent created through language. Think about our internal dialogue; it's telling us what's what all day long. Well, that's language.
That's true.
And so there's this whole Orwellian notion. Although Orwell didn't invent it, but he brought our attention to it with his doublethink and newspeak, that the culture that controls the language, or the class that controls the language, controls the dialogue, and that eventually controls the thought and the ability to think.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true in the universities, and you know, I've said that the situation in the universities now is that the people in them are hostage to dogma,
mm-hmm.
and that was a slow and insidious process. I think it had a lot to do with the humanities departments being taken over by women. And I'm not saying that to be mean or to be misogynistic. I think it's just a fact. And, you know,
you're not saying it to be controversial either.
Actually, I'm not saying it to be controversial. I think it's a fact. I think that that's what happened. And I think that a lot of what grew out of that ended up being dogmatized.
So, but can you make the link, because there's a bit of a missing piece there in terms of, it may be a fact that women took over the universities, and it may be a fact that there's been this process of degeneration, but what's the connecting tissue there? Like, why is women taking charge having this effect, in your view?
Well, you know, contrary to what the adversaries of Larry Summers at Harvard did about 4 or 5 years ago, when they tossed him out for suggesting that, you know, there may be biological differences in the way that men and women's brains work. I think there are biological differences in the way men and women's brains work.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, what's happened is that to a large degree, emotion has superseded thought in the humanities. Now a lot of the material in the humanities is based on emotion, you know, and that is to say, you know, the artistry that we find in literature and the other realms of the humanities. But you know, clearly what's happened is that you know, we're now living in a culture where emotion and the, you know, the simpler form of it, which is my feelings, now trumps everything else that you might bring to the arena, and I don't think that's been good for education, and it's now been dogmatized in the battle, you know, in the battle for supremacy of the university. It's been dogmatized to a ridiculous degree, and they've got these kids acting out the, you know, these ideological wars on campus that are actually no different than you know, than what Mao was doing in China in 1966.
And it's just, and it's disgraceful. Feelings, hurt feelings. And
yeah. Well, Mao Zedong was not concerned with hurt feelings, but he was concerned with despotically suppressing, any thought that disagreed with what he was doing. And also, you know, to a large extent, he was trying to distract the public, the Chinese public, from the failures of his own economic policies and his five-year plans, which had been disastrous and, you know, created terrible, disastrous famines and left most of the Chinese population impoverished. And so, you know, he was trying to distract them from that. And, I'm wondering how much the histrionics that are going on campus now are really an attempt to distract us from the failures of education that are taking place there.
The collapsing institutions, the collapsing environment, the fuel source, the whole situation, right?
Yeah. So now it's all just come down to the question of, like, hurt feelings. You hurt my feelings.
Yeah, well, there's a lot here to look at, needless to say. One thing that you're describing, it seems, is how does totalitarianism come to a proud democracy that believes it's completely impervious to such thing and, you know, inherently against it.
But in particular, how does it come to the supposedly progressive side of the spectrum? That's
the amazing
thing.
It comes through them. That's what I mean. It has to come as a velvet glove. It has to come through the back door. So this is all, I mean, I'm seeing it time and time again. It's all the surface narrative is a call to compassion and sensitivity.
Right.
And yet what's underneath it and behind it is the opposite.
Yeah, it's persecution, basically.
Yeah.
And a wish to be punitive.
Yeah, and this is a very deep psychological complex, is the victim who becomes the victimizer, who internalizes the victimizer. I mean, the victimizer, and constantly persecutes himself, like internally. It seems that is playing out at an external level, and not being seen or understood, needless to say, because psychology is one of the things that's kind of one of the first casualties of this, whatever we want to call this neoliberalist movement towards totalitarianism. It's very much it's essential that psychology not be factored into any of these debates. And it's very strange that a lot of it is drawn from psychology in the sense of the whole idea of trauma and being triggered. This is psychological language, but it's being used in a way that is pretty much divorced from psychology. And the same with the feminist thing. I mean, we were talking about the women who are focusing on feelings. Well, the thing that occurred to me there is also it's about subjectivity. You know, subjectivity is being raised up to the same kind of empirical status as objectivity once held, which is a weird paradox. And this was, I'd say this is one of the positive things of feminism, is that they did question this masculine academic voice of pseudo or saphead objectivity. That there is no true objective voice. They questioned and challenged that, and there was a shift there. And myself as a writer, I try to keep it as subjective as possible, but not to this point of removing all objective facts and then supplanting facts with subjective feelings.
Naturally, I think that we, in the best possible world, would want to find ourselves between those two poles. You know, we would like to have functional emotions and a functional subjective way of operating in the world and interfacing with the world, and at the same time have some grasp of our true circumstances and what is actually happening to us. I don't think that either of us or any sane person would argue that you have to be on one side or the other.
It's happening in this very covert way.
Well, but what it basically comes down to is a very poorly integrated collective personality or a poorly integrated culture composed of poorly integrated individual personalities.
Yeah, so that's my view also, and again, that it comes down to this trauma that isn't being, that hasn't been integrated, that hasn't been healed, and isn't being looked at, and so then it gets projected outward, and so all of these hurt feelings, as I say, they don't show sensitivity, mm-hmm. And they seem to be really about runaway egotism, as I can see it.
I think there's another point that I would make that you know, I've expressed discontent with the cowardice that I see in authority out there. You know, the failure of people who are in charge of things to stand up for what's right or to back the people who work for them, who have taken a brave position. And what it comes down to is that everybody has a hard time in this world. Everybody has a hard time being alive and being in this world that we live in. And you know, it takes a certain amount of just sheer bravery to carry on. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to underscore that more. That, you know, that being a crybaby is not the best way to be in the world.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we just happen to be in a culture right now that has valorized that sort of behavior, and that's very unfortunate, because we were a culture that valorized things that were truly worth valorizing, namely, mm-hmm. Perseverance and courage and the ability to carry on and withstand adversity and get mm-hmm. through it.
Honesty, also self-awareness.
Yeah.
It's so specific, because I didn't make that last point very well, but answering this one also, specifically like the triggering thing, even if there are real triggers in society that we encounter, the psychological view and understanding of triggers is that they're very useful to us. When we're triggered, we get to see the complex in us that's been triggered and to follow it back to the initial trauma, the experience that created the trigger. That is part of the psychological journey of individuation. So the whole idea of trying to ban triggers and suppress free speech so that nobody gets triggered is a defense position of the ego that doesn't want to actually experience individuation, that doesn't want to be healed. So
I think it's a very good point. Very, very good point.
And that's the crybaby position. Yeah. It wants to stay in a position of power.
And, you know, it's interesting that you use the word individuate, because one of the hallmarks of what's going on right now is it is barely possible to tell apart any of the people in these mobs who, you know, are inveighing against, being, having their feelings hurt. They all seem to be just, you know, one person.
Mm. With one ideology,
yeah, with one set of beliefs and one set of responses. So they are. I think you're quite correct in underscoring that they are actually failing to individuate.
Yeah. Well, it's the safety is in that. Could even tie that in with dissociative trance state that the group enters into, and keeps itself in. It's sort of like a psychic womb. Some kind, and so this has been my experience lately as well, is that trying to have a dialogue with individuals and being met with this wall of ideology, which not only doesn't recognize me as an individual but doesn't let me see the individual who's arguing with me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And is that happening in your community in British Columbia?
No, it's happening in my virtual community.
Mm-hmm. You do consort with a lot of people in your virtual community, and they're real people. Right. They're not virtual people.
Right.
But you're finding that you're coming into conflict with them.
Yes, although even conflict would be an improvement over this, I would say. And it's not all bad. I mean, it's mm-hmm. an enjoyable experience overall, but there's this opportunity for real understanding and for going deeper into the problem and for working on it together that often isn't happening because of this reaction that seems to come down to what you're saying is threatening, therefore I will meet it with a wall of ideology that I will not have to think about it, and I will dehumanize you by accusing you of dehumanizing me.
It's a real hall of mirrors.
And one of the things, I mean, to this point that has been bubbling on the surface for a while now, that I noticed, and it was over the transgender, particularly around this, and I don't think we need to go into that because it's a huge inflammatory subject, but I have been going into it at this forum, Rigorous Intuition, and sparking all kinds of reactions and seeing how fierce this ideology is. And what I realized is that, and because this forum is supposedly people who are parapolitical researchers who question the dominant narrative, who see social engineering behind the majority of institutions and beliefs and memes and all the rest of it. I don't know how to sum it up too succinctly, but anyway, they're questioners. Mm-hmm. And yet what I realized was that behind their defense and advocation of some of the craziest feminist and transgender agendas that are being pushed now, and they really are crazy, I don't have to tell you that, was an inherent sort of unquestioned belief in the pursuit of happiness, the mm-hmm. American idea of the pursuit of happiness,
mm-hmm.
and essentially anything that will make the personal self or the ego, whatever we want to call that, you know, happy, is good, and that each of us as individuals should have the right to pursue our happiness, doing whatever we want to do to our bodies and all the rest of it. But within the framework of the dominant ideology, which says these are the things that are good, right?
Yeah, well, and that itself is fraught with interesting contradictions, like the fact that so much of that so-called happiness among the sexually confused is being pursued by way of physical mutilation.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what's happy about that?
Yeah, and that it's, I mean, there's a huge medical industry that's making billions off this.
Yeah.
And it's not just adults choosing it, it's children who are actually being coerced into it at this point.
Quite right. And, you know, I saw something, it was about maybe, I don't know, 8 years ago or 10 years ago. In a Sunday New York Times section, it was, as chance would have it, it was in the fashion section, and that tells you a lot about what went on. And it was a story about people at Brown University who were sexually confused students who felt bad about themselves, and some dean there was. Encouraging them to go get, you know, sexual reassignment surgery. You know, mm-hmm. beginning with, you know, having their boobs surgically removed. And I just thought, my God, this is the most irresponsible thing I've seen. It's just so amazingly irresponsible that you would counsel a 19-year-old who has not fully developed a persona, let alone a physical body, to go out and permanently mutilate herself, you know, to supposedly address a problem that may be, you know, a temporary problem. It may be an imagined problem. May not be a real problem. Maybe just be a stage of development.
Yeah.
But the fact that they were doing it, they were encouraging these young women to go out and have, you know, sex change operations.
Mm-hmm.
Blew my mind. But what the real tell there was that the story was in the fashion section.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when all was said and done, this wasn't about anything. This wasn't about really ideas. This was about just some trendiness of the you know, the moment. And but it seemed to me so amazingly cruel and dangerous and irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, it wasn't recognized for what it was. You know, that these deans at the college were simply succumbing to a fashion trend. It's really despicable, actually.
And to be clear, because I went on record, it's not just teenagers; it is actually very young children.
Yeah, children are now being manipulated into, you know, declaring that they don't feel that they were born in the right body.
Mm-hmm.
Really young children who really aren't in a position to, you know, they haven't even begun to develop sexually. So, you know, what this shows is that the fantasies of the adults are, you know, being projected onto the children, and the children are being mistreated this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a mouthful right there for so many different ways in which that occurs. But I mean, personally, it creates quite a lot of anxiety in me just talking about it, because for many reasons, but specifically, like, what we're describing here is so sensitive, and there's so much damage that's potentially being done, and yet if we talk about it, there's a really good chance that we risk being accused of insensitivity, that we're being insensitive to transgender rights or whatever it is, right?
That's true, but there are worse things in the world than being accused of insensitivity.
Well, absolutely, of course. I'm not being a crybaby myself here, but just the cognitive dissonance of that is so disorienting.
Yeah.
Like, what reality am I in?
I know. Well, it's a hard time to be on this journey.
But
it's an interesting time, and I think that we too have to be brave and suck it up and do what we can to make our world a little saner, if possible.
Well, to stay sane within it, at least, as I'm.
There you go. I think you've said it better than I did.
Yeah, I try to keep my my goals humble.
You're quite right.
And it does work. I mean, it is enough, I think, is to stay grounded in what we actually know is real, and just try to gently communicate that and not get pulled out of that center into this liminal realm of... to bring it full circle to that, if a whole society is in identity crisis, institutional collapse, however we want to describe that, then the individuals within it are going to be experiencing increasing pressure. I mean, exponentially increasing, mm-hmm. I would say. And then, of course, they can be, and you don't have to posit a conspiracy theory here, it can be instinctive psychological behavior, they can be corralled into any number of solutions.
That's true. And, you know, and then you end up with the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Well, whatever the latest incarnation.
Yeah, or something, or many other things like it. Or, you know, the Aztecs, or, you know, some other, you know, crazy group behavior.
Yeah, well, it's older than history, isn't it, thing? And so it seems like we've had this temporary reprieve where we've been allowed the illusion that we've evolved beyond that.
I know, and my life was completely overlapped that particular period of history where, you know, we emerged from World War II, from the traumas of World War II, wanting to be, you know, rational, peaceful, careful, thoughtful, and I think we were for a while. I think the consensus was a little bit heavier on that end for a while. But now things have kind of, you know, the center's not holding, and everything at the margins is, looks like it's wearing a fright mask.
Mm. Well, in terms of the evolution of war, we're now living in a society which has declared war essentially on, if not everyone, then an indistinguished group mm-hmm. forever. A war that's, we're told, is never going to be over.
Yeah. The war on terror, you mean?
Yeah, although, of course, you can throw in the war on drugs and the war on cancer and the war on whatever else, you name it, because I was saying to somebody recently about America, and not just America, but if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like everything is seen, you know, everything that's undesirable is seen as something to be declared war upon.
Well, and it's, you know, by the same token, it's probably no accident that some of the groups that we're talking about call themselves social justice warriors.
Mm.
And so, you know, I'm their adversary. I'm a warrior for the other side. I'm not against social justice, but I'm against the despotism that is attending the pursuit of that.
I used to identify as a warrior more in the spiritual sense, but now I'm not too sure. I guess it's how others perceive me, but I don't really want to be perceived as a warrior, I don't think.
I like the way you referenced the martial arts, because I think there's a great deal in that that would actually take you out of the warrior state of mind at the same time that you begin from that place.
Mm.
You know, I think it ends up, I think the journey ends up being away from that to something more, you know, more peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
That's it. If you want to know more about James Howard Kunstler, go to kunstler.com or click on the link in the show notes. You can also listen to the rest of this conversation, outtakes, audio, MP3, down there in the show notes. That's at audioculture.com/liminalist. This is the Christmas podcast. I hope everyone has a not too distraught or stressful time celebrating this strange occasion, and that no family members end up being murdered. That's the best you're going to get from me, I think, as far as season's greetings. I do want to really give a heartfelt thanks to those who have donated in the last week. It's been very pleasing. I was actually thinking about maybe I'm going to have to start charging for this podcast, because I'm not getting nowhere near the target figure in order to be able to support myself and sustain the podcast. I would like to then thank those people who are by name Mark, Stephanie, Elizabeth, Anne, Zachary, and Paul. Please keep it coming, and I will return the favor and keep these podcasts coming. Stay warm, be good, keep on digging.
And monkeys boo when his world came to